sticks his arm out. They're on him before he gets more than his fingers into the cage. One of them gets a hold of his hand and pulls him closer, biting down on his arm like it's a drumstick. Othello's shout of pain echoes through the auditorium, and in the rows ahead of us, a few of the ladies get the vapors. Their girls are on them immediately, passing smelling salts under their noses and escorting them out, half carrying them. I'm sad to see that Maisie Carpenter is one of them. She was a solid marksman. It would be nice to have her here when it all goes to hell. Up on stage, the professor and another man are pulling Othello back from the cage and settling him into the stage's lone chair. The shamblers are frantic now that they got the taste of fresh meat. They sniff the air, their yellow eyes scanning the crowd as they look for their next meal. Someone should walk up on stage and put them down, but no one is paying any attention to the caged dead. Instead, everyone is focused on Othello, leaning back in his chair, panting like a man that just ran a foot race. "Kate," I began. "Jane, I am not sure why you insist on calling me by that horrid nickname, but if I've told you once, I've told you a million times." "Look at the stage, Kate. Look at Othello." Her gaze meets mine. "He's going to turn." Professor Gehring addresses the crowd. His benign smile is less sure now, and people in the audience are beginning to speak amongst themselves, concern rising like the tide.
"Please calm yourselves. Othello is quite unaffected, but even if something should go wrong, research has shown that a living person bitten by a shambler will take at minimum a half hour to turn. If we all check our pocket watches..."
"I'm afraid that estimate is incorrect, Professor." Miss Duncan stands, her voice ringing out loud and clear over the rest of the crowd. It's the same voice that has led us in countless drills, and everyone stops talking. "I know it's likely been a while since you city folk have witnessed a turning, but those that have been bitten can and do change immediately. The 30-minute rule is outdated and has been summarily disproven by Mr. Pasteur over in France. I recommend we evacuate now, before we have a catastrophe on our hands." The professor opens his mouth, but before he can speak, a low growl comes from the rear of the stage. Othello stands behind the good professor. His eyes are yellow. Saliva drips from his mouth, and his lips are turned up in a feral snarl. He leaps. Shouts of alarm echo throughout the auditorium. In the cage, the other shamblers are going wild, throwing themselves against the bars in an attempt to get a bite of their own. People panic like a herd of spooked cattle, men and women pushing against one another to get out of the lecture hall. No one ever keeps a cool head when shamblers are about.
"Ladies!"
We're on our feet at Miss Duncan's gentle summons. "Catherine, go out and see if you can get a rifle from one of the men who were supposed to be guarding the door. Jane, take the sidearm under your skirts and put those shamblers down." I open my mouth to deny it, but Miss Duncan gives me a stern look.
"Not now, Jane. We shall discuss your concealed weapon later, in addition to your highly improper outburst. Girls," she says, turning to the younger ones, some of whom are crying.
They've probably never seen a shambler go after a man like Othello is going after the professor. Or if they have, the sight is probably waking some very unpleasant memories.
"We need to stay calm and escort these nice people out of the building before they trample one another. Jane, if you could get their attention."
I nod, reaching up under my skirts and pulling out my revolver. I fire a shot into the air, and the sound is enough to startle folks out of their terror for just a moment.
"Ladies and gentlemen," I say, "if you would be so good as to follow Miss Preston's girls out of the lecture hall, we have the situation under control."
That last bit is a lie. But the easiest lie to tell is the one people want to believe.
Even though a man is being devoured on stage, they're still more worried about their own hides. They begin to file out quickly, but much more calmly, the professor all but forgotten. It's a cruel, cruel world, and the people are the worst part.
And I dare say you would be incredibly impressed with my marksmanship skills. I am a crack shot, far beyond any of the other girls, and that is not boastfulness. I often wonder if part of that might be due to your tutelage at Rose Hill.
Chapter 6, In which all hell breaks loose. I push my way through the crowd to the front of the room, where Othello has just about had his fill of the professor. Gehring is still mostly alive, but before I put him out of his misery, I have to put down Othello. While at Miss Preston's, I've ended enough dead to give myself a lifetime of nightmares. The trick is not to think of them as regular folks. When you do that, your emotions get all tangled up. You start to wonder whether it's right or wrong, and what kind of person that makes you for taking their life. Whatever kind of existence it may be. Your brain starts doubting, and those second thoughts can get you killed. But when you think of shamblers as things, as mindless creatures who have to be put down so that we might live, ending them gets to be a lot easier. The farmer doesn't cry over slaughtering a hog. So that's what I think about when I slay shamblers. Not who they might have once been, and what kind of life there is after death, but how them being gone makes the people I care about safer, and how each body gets me closer to getting back home to my mama and Rose Hill Plantation. For Othello, his end puts me one step closer to my beginning. I don't even flinch when I put the bullet in his head. This close to the stage, it's an easy shot. Suffice it to say, the result is untidy. I climb the stairs to the stage and look down at Professor Gehring. He's a mess. His throat is missing, and his fancy waistcoat is soaked with blood. He ain't breathing, and most folks would usually assume that means he's not getting up again. But I know better. My time at Miss Preston's has taught me a few things. In all my killing the dead, this is the first time I've stood over a man I thought deserved it. I ain't sorry this happened to you. With a fool's pride comes disgrace, or something like that. I don't know what good it is to say I told you so to a dead man, but it makes me feel a little bit better, especially after being humiliated for speaking out. I shoot Professor Gehring right between the eyes, just as I did Othello. Then once more, because seeing the man so casually turned for some blowhard's cause has put me in a fine temper. I'm about to holster my revolver when there's a low growl behind me. The thing about a shambler's cage is that it ain't designed to hold anything long-term. When you set those traps up, you're supposed to hide somewhere nearby so you can put the dead down real quick. Unfortunately, Professor Gehring and his survivalist cronies thought they were smarter than the average foot patrol. So I shouldn't be surprised when the iron lock finally breaks loose, releasing three blood-crazed shamblers. What is left of the departing crowd goes frantic. People nearest the stage shout in alarm and begin shoving. Their fear draws the attention of the shamblers, and one of them jumps off the raised platform right down into the seats. I'm quicker on the draw, and once I get a bead on the shambler, I put him down with a headshot. But the crowd's already spooked. I ain't got time to worry about a bunch of dandies running for their lives. Shamblers ain't like normal people, but they do have an eerie ability to recognize a threat when they see it. Putting down their hunting buddy effectively made me a target, and when the two remaining shamblers turned toward me, slack mouths open in a hungry growl, I know I'm in for it. They stalk toward me across the stage. Inside, my heart is pounding, my blood thrumming in my ears as the fear response urges me to run, run, run. But I ain't no coward. I've got two shots left. I just need to make them count.
I line up my sights on the bigger shambler and squeeze the trigger. The revolver recoils, smoke filling the air. He drops and I take aim at the last one. She opens her mouth wide, growling low in her throat. She's fresh dead, so she doesn't have the blackened saliva that so many of the older ones do. Still, drool runs down her chin and the front of her calico dress. I feel bad for her. She wasn't rich in life, her clothing belying her poverty, and even her death has been insulting. Changed into a shambler, locked up in a cage, paraded on stage, that ain't a fitting end for anyone. I think through all of this in the few heartbeats between lining up my shot and pulling the trigger. Click. Empty. Quickly, I count through my shots. One in Othello, two in the professor, one in the jumper, and another in the other male. That's only five. And one in the air to get everyone's attention. Jane, you damn fool. The shambler ain't waiting for me to figure out what happened to my last bullet. She vaults toward me, a murderous blur set on a collision course with disaster. I swear, under my breath, because a lady's attendant never curses aloud, and brace myself for impact. A shot rings out, and I turn to see an attendant in the middle of the aisle, her hands shaking. Behind her is a crumpled heap of crinolines and lace. The attendant's charge has passed out, and the woman's serving girl is trying to alternately drag her or revive her with smelling salts while the attendant provides a distraction. Unfortunately, the attendant is providing the wrong kind of spectacle, because the shambler lurches off the stage and after the trio in the aisle. I launch myself off after her. The shambler runs up the aisle toward the prone woman, who I can see now is the mayor's wife. The serving girl looks up, her eyes round as saucers as the shambler bears down on her.
Shoot it!
I shout to the attendant in the aisle, but she drops her sidearm and runs, the girl with the smelling salts close behind. Needless to say, neither of them were ever Miss Preston's girls.
Damn it to hell,
I yell, this time not quite able to keep the language to myself. The shambler is close enough to Mrs. Carr to get a good bite out of her, and I decide to do the stupidest thing ever. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Catch a shambler by the toe. I dive at the dead woman, grabbing her one-handed by the ankle. She goes down, flat on her belly, only a few inches away from the unconscious woman. The shambler kicks out, her heel catching me in the mouth and splitting my lip. I grunt and my grip slips. She tries to drag herself toward Mrs. Carr, and I grab the shambler's ankle again with both hands and haul her back, groaning as I climb to my feet. The dead woman lets loose a sound somewhere between frustration and fury. She twists around in my grip, lunging for me. The woman is faster than I expect, and I take a stumbling step back. My feet tangle in my skirts, and I fall, the shambler following. I throw up my hands, using my forearms to block the weight of her torso before she can take a bite out of my face. She claws at me as I hold her back, my hands locked around her throat. I push her up and away, locking my elbows and hiding my face in my shoulder, trying to avoid her scrabbling hands. She pulls at the brim of Catherine's bonnet, more interested in yanking my face to her teeth than in freeing herself. I'm trying to figure out how to get her off of me when there's a loud report and something cold and wet splashes on my face. The shambler goes limp, and I push her to the side, climbing to my feet as I wipe blood and the shambler's brains off of my cheek. I look around to see who just saved my bacon, and I meet the eyes of the most remarkable man I've ever seen. He stands at the back of the room, a rifle in his hand. His straight dark hair is chin length, his jaw square. His skin, the same deep brown as mine. He wears a strange outfit, some kind of canvas pants that I've never seen before, with a checkered shirt. My mouth falls open. part shock and part plain old rudeness. I ain't too proud to admit that I stare at him as he watches me. But it ain't entirely my fault. I never saw an Indian before. Of course, I've read the newspaper weeklies about them, The Chieftain's Son, Plains Bride, and my favorite, Two Braves of Yellow Rock, which is a story about two Cherokee brothers, one that chooses the white man's way and the other who becomes the chief of his tribe. Mama loved those stories, and when the paper would come, we'd read them together, marveling over tales of a frontier untouched by the blight of the restless dead. Mama used to say the Indian was even worse off than the Negro, because instead of being taken from his land, he'd had his land taken from him. The man looks across the rapidly thinning audience at me, just as I'm staring at the fellow that saved my life. But then the Indian gives me a scowl, as though I am the most repugnant thing he's ever seen, and turns and leaves the lecture hall. Well, Catherine comes running up, a revolver in her hand, huffing and puffing as she tries to get a full breath. I glare at her. Where have you been?
I had to run all the way down the street to find those dimwits. They were still searching for the shambler you sent them chasing after.
Catherine looks at me and frowns.
What happened to my bonnet?
I don't answer her. I just take it off, hand it to her, and walk out to find Miss Duncan. I've had enough higher education to last me a lifetime. A few of the girls here seem to find all sorts of mischief, constantly in trouble with the headmistress. You'll be happy to hear that I am not one of them. Chapter 7, in which I receive invitations both expected and unexpected. Someone shakes me awake. I crack one eye open, notice the pale gray light filtering through the bars on the windows, and grunt. You better be shaking me for a good reason. Come on, a voice says from the dark. It's Catherine. She stalks off, and I reluctantly rise for our fourth straight day of house duty. After we'd put down all of the shamblers, Mayor Carr had been kind enough to let us use his personal carriage to get back to the school. I'm guessing this generosity came on account of me saving his wife and all. The engine chugged through the twilight, moving down the road much more quickly than the rented carriages we'd taken to Baltimore. The steam engine had been nearly whisper quiet, the hiss low enough that we didn't attract a single shambler from the surrounding woods. The seats had also been more comfortable, and the interior large enough to fit all of us in one pony. I didn't think the taxpayers would be too keen on hearing that their elected official traveled in unrivaled luxury while they were forced to ride in barrels pushed along by clanking old engines. When we got back, Miss Duncan had marched us right into Miss Preston's office. At first, I thought maybe we were going to get a ribbon or something for our valorous conduct. What we got was another lecture.
I'm surprised at you girls, Miss Preston yawned wide, likely on account of the late hour. You know better than to gallivant around wearing corsets and carrying firearms. You're in your last year. I expect better from students about to graduate.
Miss Preston, I said, raising my hand, can I just say that I am truly remorseful for my conduct? I understand that it is dismaying to know that a girl might be wont to strap a revolver to her thigh before attending an educational event. However, without my revolver, those shamblers could have easily turned half that room. Wearing a corset is far more egregious a transgression. After all, the stays of the corset limit movement, and not being able to draw a proper breath could be the difference between life and death for the wearer. I could feel Catherine glare at me as I offered her up in the hopes of saving my own hide. And I'm certain that by the end, she fairly had steam coming from her ears.
small price to pay to avoid getting the switch. But Miss Preston was having none of it.
Jane, your point is well taken, but heroism means little when it rests on lawlessness. And don't think Miss Duncan didn't inform me of your outburst during the lecture. There are rules in this world, rules that are the only thing separating us from the restless dead. This isn't the wild days of the years of discord when anarchy reigned. We expect you to hold yourselves to a higher standard in civilized society. No, your choices were just as poor as Catherine's. Both of you can look forward to getting the strap tomorrow after breakfast.
Miss Duncan cleared her throat, and Miss Preston let out a sigh.
Yes, Amelia?
Headmistress, if it isn't too much to ask, perhaps the girls could be given house detail instead of the strap. I know their behavior was appalling, but I'd hate for them to have to miss any of the upcoming drills this week because they're laid up. The first-year girls are learning the sickle this week, and I need Catherine and Jane to help instruct. Also, I believe it should be recognized that without them, this evening could surely have ended in tragedy. I know Mayor Carr is a close personal friend of yours, and even he was quite insistent that the girls had done a remarkable job.
That last bit was a little fabrication on Miss Duncan's part. What the mayor had actually said was, "It's nice that we can depend on the Negro to do their part."
His tone had been almost insulting. If you ask me, neither the mayor nor any of these other folks were taking things seriously enough. For all the mayor knows, there's some other professor bringing the dead into city limits to work experiments on them. Who knows how long it will be until we're back in the dark days of the war against the dead. Regardless, it fell out that Catherine and I were saved the corporal punishment and instead assigned house duty for 2 weeks. Housework ain't too bad, and I ain't ashamed to say this ain't my first time doing it. It was a standard punishment whenever a girl did wrong. Poor marks, laziness, a general bad attitude. Miss Preston was convinced that the best way to correct minor misconduct was a little drudgery, and housework was the pinnacle of drudge. So Catherine and I spent our free time polishing silver, dusting banisters, beating carpets, and a dozen other randomly assigned tasks. We got up early in the morning and dragged ourselves to the kitchen, eating cold porridge that the cook gave us with a scowl. Then we started our chores 2 hours before class, returning after dinner to help cook scrub the day's pots and pans, before heading off to bed. For 3 straight days, Catherine refused to speak a lick. Now on the 4th day, though, she talks.
"Your friend is here."
I don't even look up. We're on our hands and knees scrubbing the marble floor in the rear of the main building. It's one of Miss Preston's favorite chores. Sometime before the school was taken over by Miss Preston's, some poor soul was killed here, his life blood seeping into the stone. It would have been easier to take up the stained tiles, but marble is expensive and hard to come by. So instead we scrub, trying to erase the signs of some bastard's last few breaths. This is the 50th time I've been made to scrub this same patch of floor over the 3 or so years I've been at Miss Preston's, so I know it well. The rust-colored stain ain't coming out. But scrubbing ain't the worst way to pass an afternoon. The foyer is cool, thanks to the marble, and the sounds of girls outside practicing their remedial drills drifts in through the open windows.
"Jane?"
"Hmm?" Catherine nods toward one of the big windows.
"Your friend, the ruffian, is here. And you know that's against the rules."
I look over, and climbing in through one of the open windows is Red Jack, looking fresh as a daisy in a yellow waistcoat. His bowler is new as well, and he presents a dapper image. I straighten but don't stand, kneeling with my hands on my hips.
"What are you doing here?"
You didn't come by the barrel house on Sunday. You said you'd bring me some of that sugar.
He says it with a wink that makes it abundantly clear that he's being unseemly. I forgot, Jackson, and I wasn't bringing you anything but my blade.
Anyway, I heard about your escapade through the grapevine, so I figured that, as per the usual, Jane McKean had found herself in a spot of trouble with her headmistress. Hello there,
Jackson says, tipping his hat to Catherine. She scowls and climbs to her feet. I'm going to go fetch Miss Anderson. I grab her skirts. Not if you want to keep those pretty curls, you ain't. Catherine's eyes narrow. Are you threatening me, Jane?
Nah, I don't make threats.
She looks from me to Jackson one last time before stomping out into the hallway. I drop the scrub brush into my bucket and climb to my feet. Now is not a good time, Jackson. Give me whatever it is you mentioned in Baltimore and get going.
He shrugs. Don't much care. And I ain't here about that. You owe me one, and I aim to collect.
Owe you? Since when am I owing you anything?
Riverbend, 2 months ago. I saved your life.
You nearly got me killed, I shriek. The echo of voices in the hallway filter toward us. At least two women, probably Catherine and Miss Anderson. Of course, that high yellow Jezebel told on me. Girl would rat out Jesus to the Romans. I sigh, grabbing Red Jack by his arm and dragging him back toward the window. Listen here, Redbone, and listen well. This is not a good time. I don't know what you think I owe you or why, but we'll settle it up later. You need to go. I get in trouble again, and I'm either going to get the strap or expelled. I'm already on probation, and getting caught with you ain't going to help my case. Red Jack pulls his arm from my grip and adjusts his hat.
Lily is missing,
he says, his voice low and choked. That stoppers my rage. Lily is Jackson's younger sister, sweet as sugar and as pretty as a summer day. There is no one Jackson cares about more than her. Well, she can't have been gone long. I saw her the same day I saw you in Baltimore. She and Mrs. Spencer brought us lemonade.
Yep, they're still letting her stay with them, God bless them, but they've all disappeared.
Maybe they went on a trip? Mrs. Spencer's people are from Delaware. Mayhap they traveled up that way.
Can't be. Laverne just had a babe 2 months past.
Folks rarely just up and vanish like that, unless... Shamblers? I ask, trying to be as delicate as I have the wherewithal to be.
He shakes his head. No. There hasn't been an attack reported in months, and I didn't notice any blood when I went by there. I would have found some sign of them if it had been the dead. It's just nothing.
I take a deep breath and let it out slowly. So you want me to look and see if I can find something you missed?
You're smarter than anyone I know, Jane, and I'm not just saying that so you'll help me. If I've missed something, some sign of what happened to them, I know you're the person to find it.
A year ago, I would have chalked this up to shamblers and been done with it. But if what Red Jack says is true, it does sound like a bit of a mystery. I reach under my shirt and run my thumb over my lucky penny. There's no chill and no flash of brilliance, so my luck charm isn't any kind of help this time. Red Jack watches me but says nothing, his face a pleasant half-smile that could easily mean he's enjoying a fine tale or he's planning on stealing someone's watch. That's his worried face, which makes me even more concerned. Fine, I'll help you. He breaks out into a wide grin.
That a girl. You got a letter for me to send?
I dig the envelope out from the hidden pocket I've sewn into the hem of my day dress.
We're not supposed to send letters home, because Miss Preston thinks that it's a distraction from our studies. But I can always count on Jackson to smuggle something to the post for me. You got any letters for me? Jackson shakes his head.
Nope. Well, don't worry. I'm sure your ma's just been busy.
For a whole year? Not likely. I hold the letter out, and he tucks it into his breast pocket. Jackson's expression goes soft.
Thanks for agreeing to help me.
I nod. Just enough of this owing you nonsense. We're either friends or we're not, Jackson. And friends don't keep score.
Oh, Jane, obviously you haven't had many friends.
Before I can snarl a reply, Red Jack tips his bowler, flips something at me that I catch in midair, and slips out the window, quick as he came. I look down at what he tossed me. It's a new book, Tom Sawyer, by a fella named Mark Twain. I tuck it into my hidden pocket and then button the thing shut for safekeeping. I'm going with you. I turn around. Catherine's hands are on her hips, and she looks to be spoiling for a fight. Surprisingly, Miss Anderson is nowhere to be found. Maybe she didn't tell on me. Doesn't mean I'm about to take her with me on my late-night escapades. I ain't going anywhere, Kate. You about done with this floor? I'm going to see if Miss Preston has anything else for us before I wash up. Stop calling me Kate. I detest that nickname. And don't lie to me. You're going to sneak out tonight with that boy to visit the Spencer's farm, and I'm going with you. What a sneaky little eavesdropper. Why? My reasons are my own business, she sniffs, just as haughty as ever. You're going to have to do better than that. Fine, she huffs. The Spencers are good people. If something happened to them, I want to find out what. Besides, you could use my help if you get into trouble. That Jackson boy doesn't seem like the most reliable in a fight. I open my mouth to protest, but she ain't done. Anyway, it's the least you can do after destroying my bonnet. Right on cue, a pounding sensation begins behind my eyes. I didn't destroy your bonnet. Like I told you, it was that Indian man with the damn rifle. That intriguing man with the rifle who had looked at me with disdain. I'm still wondering how he happened to be there, ready to put down a shambler just when I needed him. Really, Jane, you shouldn't swear. Either way, you still owe me for the bonnet and for sullying my relationship with Miss Preston. Besides, I didn't tell Miss Anderson about your bow or the book he brought you. And I still could. She's right. Trying to give Catherine over to save my own hide hadn't been my finest moment. And if I really think about it, I do feel the tiniest bit guilty. Plus, now she's got a whole load of dirt on me. It's in my best interest to keep on her good side. If she wants to tag along, then that is on her. Fine, but you need to listen to me and listen well. We get caught, and the punishment is going to be far worse than housework. We will get the strap, or worse, expelled. So make sure you know what you're asking for. We leave 2 hours after lights out. Now, can we please dump this dirty water and get on with our lives? Catherine nods, and we each grab a bucket, hefting them back to the kitchen. We're halfway down the hall when Catherine murmurs, "So, about your beau?" "He ain't my beau." "Really? Because he seems like your beau, bringing you gifts and all." I turn to look at her, but she's serious. Does she really think that's what courting looks like? Red Jack inspires feelings of murder in me, not love. It wasn't always like that. But Catherine ain't asking about ancient history. No. He's a mistake I have no intention of repeating. Oh, I was just wondering. I watch her as we haul our buckets down the hall. Does Catherine fancy Jackson? She's pretty enough, and Jackson's type is anything he thinks he can tumble. Still, the thought of them together is enough to make me more than a little stabby. Jealousy is a terrible thing, and I swallow the emotion down hard as I can. I consider warning her that taking a turn with Jackson is beyond a terrible idea. But I decide to save my breath. If anyone had tried to tell me a year ago that blue-green-eyed Jack would break my heart, I wouldn't have believed them. That's the way it is when you fancy someone. Your heart starts doing the thinking, and your brain, well, it gets left out of the equation until too late. Either way, Catherine can discover what kind of scoundrel Jackson is on her own. My one regret about leaving Rose Hill in such haste all those years ago is that I feel like I never got to give you a proper goodbye, Mama. I know how you sometimes see fit to hold a grudge. I hope your lack of letters isn't tied to you being in a fine temper. It's hard to apologize when the miles steal every last bit of affection. Chapter 8, in which I relate the circumstances surrounding my departure from Rose Hill Plantation. The day the truancy officers came for the children of Rose Hill Plantation, I hid in the summer kitchen with Auntie Aggie. That wasn't the first time the white men with their long beards and narrow eyes had come to Rose Hill, taking every Negro boy and girl away to be educated. But it was the first time it was obvious to the naked eye that I was of an age to get carted off along with the rest. So Mama had grabbed me by the arm and dragged me around the back of the house when she heard the chug and wheeze of the government ponies coming into the front yard, the federal seal painted on the side of the steam-powered metal carriages. "Keep her away from those bureaucratic bastards. Keep her safe," she said to Auntie Aggie before sweeping out to greet the truancy officers. She was, after all, the lady of the estate, and it fell to her to pay for one of the better combat schools for her charges, should she be so inclined. The government called it an investment. Mama called it extortion. Either way, Mama had entrusted Auntie Aggie to hide me, to keep me at Rose Hill Plantation. I'd been hiding every year since I'd been 11, and now at 14, I was more than old enough to get carted off to one of the government schools. Mama wasn't about to let that happen. Auntie Aggie had other ideas. "Jane, come here." I walked over, and she held me out at arm's length, an expression equal parts sadness and acceptance working across her dark features. "You got to go with the officers, girl." "Mama doesn't want me to go." I didn't much want to go either. There was a big, scary world beyond the boundaries of Rose Hill. I was bold, but not so foolhardy as to think there was something worthwhile on the other side of the barrier fence that kept the dead out. Auntie Aggie nodded, as though she'd heard my unspoken thoughts. "Yes, but your mama don't always do what's best for you. Sometimes your mama can be powerful selfish, and this is one of those times." I knew that what Auntie Aggie said was the truth. I'd witnessed Mama's fits firsthand.
"But if I go, I'll die," I said, my voice half a whine.
"No, you won't, Jane. Don't you know that you're special? Ain't your mama told you as much?" I shrugged, because Mama did always tell me what a special girl I was. But I didn't always feel special. I mostly just felt different. After all, no one else could claim the plantation's mistress as their mama and an unknown field hand as their papa. "Come here, Jane." She swept me up into a fierce hug. "You are a special girl."
"How do you know that?" I asked, my words muffled by her generous bosom.
Auntie Aggie laughed, voice husky. "Because I know things. I know that you got a great destiny ahead of you, just like your mama, and that Rose Hill ain't no place for you, not anymore."
You need to go out in the big wide world and find yourself. And the big wide world needs to find you. There's a whole bunch of folk out there trying to figure out this plague, and ain't nobody done it yet. You ask me, they might be wanting for some fresh ideas. I stepped out of the hug and frowned at Auntie Aggie.
Being out in the world ain't gonna do me much good if I get gobbled up by shamblers.
She nodded and reached into the pocket of her skirt.
That's why I got you this. Miss Fifi made it for you.
Auntie Aggie held out a necklace. It was simple enough, a penny with a hole in it so it could hang on a string. But I knew well enough that if Miss Fifi was involved, the necklace was more than what met the eye. Miss Fifi was the woman you went to when you wanted to catch the attention of a handsome fellow, or when your menses were late but you weren't looking to carry a child. Some folks called Miss Fifi a healer. Most weren't so kind.
Mama don't like hoodoo, I said,
but I still held my hand out for that necklace. I ain't never been one to turn down a gift, even if it could be cursed. Your mama ain't got to know. Miss Fifi said you should wear this at all times, that it'll warn you when there's danger about. Now hurry, put it on before the truancy man comes and gets you. I took the necklace and slipped it over my head. The penny settled in the hollow of my chest, its weight warm and comforting. Now, Auntie Aggie said, kissing me on each cheek, go out there and tell that truancy man you're ready to go to school. The one drawback to attending Miss Preston's is the quiet. It is ever so calm and safe here, with most of us having not a care in the world beyond our studies. Chapter 9, in which I have an accomplice and we skulk in the shadows. I've snuck out of Miss Preston's many times. In the beginning, it was because I was homesick, and it was a comfort to be able to lie on the sprawling lawn and know I was under the same big moon as Mama and Auntie Aggie back in Kentucky. I'd lie in the grass in my white hand-me-down nightgown and stare up at the sky, the occasional growls and moans of the shamblers at the barrier fence barely audible over the sound of my crying. But that didn't last long, and it got so that I was sneaking out less because I was homesick, and more because I just enjoyed the freedom. There's something about skulking around while everyone else is fast asleep that you can't put words to. Eventually, after a few months or so, I got bored enough with the sneaking about to jump the barrier fence. After all, Auntie Aggie had sent me away from Rose Hill so that I could see the whole big world, and that meant something besides the grass of Miss Preston's. This was back when Baltimore County was filthy with shamblers, and sometimes I would hunt them in the dark, just another monster slinking through the deep shadows. Other times, I would climb a tree and watch the folks dumb enough to travel at night, their whispers too loud, their reactions too slow. I would try to help out, jumping down from my perch and coming to their aid like some guardian angel. That was how I'd met Red Jack. Curse my terrible luck. Most days I think I should have just let him get eaten. But sometimes I couldn't help the people on the road when the shamblers came. I didn't risk taking a gun for these nocturnal excursions, and my sickles were only so fast. There were too many nights when jumping down to lend my steel would only have ended in my own demise. Those nights were the worst. My nightly wanderings more often than not ended well, and I learned a lot from the shamblers I watched. I figured out they preferred to hunt in packs, and that the old ones were slow, while the new ones were just as fast as a regular person. I discovered that they couldn't outrun a deer, but they could take down a dog if given enough time. I found that their sight isn't as good as it seems, but their hearing is much, much better. I learned that they can't help but gather up in a horde, and the dead are never lonely, that their natural inclination is to have a lot of friends. And I discovered that shamblers are never, ever satisfied. They are always hungry. And just when you think you're safe, when you let your guard down, that's when they get you. I also learned to tell the look of a man that's been bit and the moment the change starts to take hold. The way he shakes like he's got a chill and the way his eyes begin to yellow. I learned that I can be ruthless when I need to, and I can be merciful when I'm able. I learned that there is nothing to fear in the dark if you're smart, and I had no doubt that I was pretty damn clever. But no matter how much my nightly travels may have taught me, I am still stupid enough to let Catherine tag along. A clever girl would have found a way to keep Catherine at the school, frightened her off with tales of evening slaughter on the roads, of shamblers and bandits and men that lurk in the shadows at night, ready to steal a girl's virtue. A smart girl would have just left her behind and taken the eventual punishment when Catherine told Miss Preston about unauthorized visitors and subsequent midnight departures. But I am a stupid girl. So midnight finds me leading Catherine out the rarely used side door to the summer kitchen behind the school. The door doesn't make a sound when I open it. It's my usual route, and the hinges are well oiled. That doesn't keep Catherine from squeaking, though. "What?" I whisper, irritated that we haven't even made it outside, and she's already working on getting us caught. "Something ran across my foot. Probably just a mouse. Now pipe down before you wake someone." I head straight toward an abandoned outbuilding on the far edge of the property. It was once used to house the slaves the men's college owned, but it's empty now that slavery, the kind that ended with the war between the states anyway, is no more. The building is long and low, with a door on either side. I use the door on the opposite end of the school, just in case anyone happens to glance out her window. The moon is high tonight and casts a pale silver over the landscape, painting it in shadows and light. It's a good night for investigating. It's also a good night to get caught by a teacher doing her rounds on the perimeter fence. I try not to think about that. Inside of the old slave cabin, I go to a dusty cabinet and take out my personal sickles, a set Red Jack gave me a long time ago as a gift, and an extra set since Catherine didn't bring any of hers. Both sets are well made, balanced, and sharp, and I take care of them so they stay that way. I set them on a rickety table and take out a pair of trousers, tossing them to Catherine. "Put these on." She holds them out in front of her, her horror visible in the moonlight coming in through the empty window pane. "You want me to wear a pair of men's trousers?" Her voice is just short of hysterical. "Yes." She shakes her head. "That is the height of indecency. I am not wearing these." We're going to be walking through the woods, up and down hills and through underbrush. Skirts get caught on branches and whatnot. Plus, if we do have to fight off a shambler, skirts are a liability. We're less likely to get killed if we can run. You wear them, or you stay here. I take out another pair of trousers for myself before I pause. "You better not be wearing a corset." She sniffs. "I'm not. I learned my lesson. Thank you very much." She casts a bit of side eye at the trousers once more before sighing. "If you tell anyone about this, Jane McKean, I will make sure you spend the rest of your time at Miss Preston's on housework." I snort, because it's an empty threat, and we both know it. But I don't say anything more. Sometimes I am a gracious winner. I pull on my own set of trousers, tucking my sleep shirt in the waistband. Catherine copies my movements. I show her the loops near the waist for weapons and how to secure the waist ties and extra strings at the ankles. And then, after handing her my spare set of sickles, we secure our weapons and are off into the night. It takes us nearly 2 hours to go the scant distance to the Spencer's farm because we have to walk slower than a blind turtle. Catherine is skittish as all get out, and I have to remind myself repeatedly that she ain't used to creeping around in the dark like I am. The woods are dense with thickets and patches of poison ivy that we have to make our way around. Plus, our part of Maryland is hilly. I don't think there's a single flat patch of land, and huffing and puffing up and down those hills takes a while. By the time we finally make it to the Spencer's farm, it's closer to sunrise than I'd like. The Spencers are one of the most prominent families in the area, and very generous to us Preston girls, so I've been out to their homestead a fair few times. The last was in early spring when Miss Preston sent the older girls round to the local farms to help with clearing the fields once the thaw came and the dead got a mind to start walking again. Mrs. Spencer was always the kindest, bringing out warm milk and biscuits with jam once the killing was done. She also makes an amazing strawberry rhubarb pie that won a blue ribbon at the county fair a few years back. The thought of something happening to her makes me a little sad, but I shove the emotion down deep. I need to stay sharp. Red Jack meets us a little ways from the barrier gate to the homestead proper. He wears a rough sponge shirt and trousers for a change, shedding his flashy attire for something a little more sensible. In the pale moonlight, I see Catherine's eyes widen as she takes him in. I understand why. Jackson is as pretty in rough cotton as he is in fine silk. Plus, his sleeves are rolled up, revealing his finely muscled forearms. He used to work on the docks back before he realized he could make more money taking odd jobs, as he calls them, on the roads between Baltimore and the outer settlements. It's no wonder poor Catherine is smitten with him. "You two have any trouble?" Red Jack asks, his voice low.
"No, we didn't see a single shambler," Catherine says, her voice loud and disappointed.
"Not for lack of trying," I mutter, shooting her a dark look. Both she and Jackson ignore me. Red Jack gestures toward the main house.
"I walked up and around the property. There's no one there. All of the windows are still intact, and the front door is latched. It's like they left on an errand and never came back."
There's a slight tremor to his voice, barely noticeable. I don't say anything because I understand why he's upset. People, especially those that are well off, are heard to move around, try their luck in a different city or settlement. The Spencers could have done just that and taken Lily with them and somehow forgot to tell anyone they were doing so. But I've learned that the simplest explanation is usually the right one. And that means shamblers. I don't care how safe these lands are supposed to be. Jack said that there was no evidence of a break-in, but he couldn't have gotten a good look inside yet. The dead tend to leave a lot of evidence, very messy evidence. If the Spencers were attacked, as unlikely as that is, we'll know soon enough. I sigh loudly, dreading the task at hand. I'm tired of seeing people I care about die. Come on, I'll check out the perimeter, then we'll let ourselves inside to see what's going on. We walk down toward the homestead on cat feet, quiet except for the sound of our breathing. Even Catherine, who tromped through the woods like she was flushing rabbits, is silent. Her footsteps whisper soft. Shamblers are attracted to sound, so if we are discreet enough, any dead in the area shouldn't even know we're here. The Spencer's house is a modest thing. It's newer, built in the years after the dead started to walk. You can always tell by the square windows, which are large enough to allow some light, but too small to let a body in. Tripwires with early warning alarms are scattered throughout the yard, but these are clearly marked by stakes in the ground, and we step over them easily. On the small porch, there are a couple of rocking chairs and hooks holding sickles, a scythe, and extra sharp swords within close reach, in case shamblers get through the barrier fence. These sorts of modest protections and alarms have been adequate for settlements in the county these last few years. Jackson pulls a set of slim metal pieces from his pocket, a lock-picking set. Catherine's brows draw together in a frown, and her lips purse in displeasure. She opens her mouth to say something, but I catch her eye and shake my head. There are some things she's better off not knowing, and the sordid details surrounding that lock-picking set is one of them. Red Jack unlocks the door easily, and it swings open on quiet hinges. I grip my sickles, ready to swipe at anything that comes out, but nothing does. I look to Jackson and Catherine, both of whom are looking at me. Oh, I take it I'm going in first? Catherine sniffs. You do have the highest marks in close quarters combat. I swallow a laugh. She has no idea. I roll my shoulders a couple of times, trying to loosen up the suddenly tense muscles. Then I walk into the dark. The windows only let in a tiny bit of the moonlight, so it's hard to see anything. I make out a table, a long, cold stove, a few chairs around a nearby fireplace. But there's no one in the room, dead or otherwise.
There's a lamp on the table, Jackson says,
his voice close to my ear. It takes everything I have not to jump. Well, light it. I can't see a damn thing in this gloom. Jane? Language, Catherine calls from somewhere behind me. Jackson walks over to the table and lights the oil lamp. Once it's turned up, it's easy to see that the interior of the house is completely undisturbed. There ain't even a dirty dish in the sink. If their disappearance was the work of shamblers, they were the tidiest shamblers I've ever heard of. You sure Lily didn't mention anything about them all heading somewhere? I ask, even though I already know the answer to my question. Jackson shakes his head.
The iron pony is still in the barn, stocked full of coal, and look,
he gestures to the wall where a portrait of the family hangs. Mr. and Mrs. Spencer and their two little ones, their pale faces staring out at us. If they'd picked up and left, they most definitely would have taken the family photo. Catherine drags a finger across the ledge of a china hutch. They've been gone for a while. Either that or Mrs. Spencer is an inadequate housekeeper, she says, holding up a dusty finger. Why was your sister staying with them, anyway? Jackson's jaw tightens, and I answer for him. Lily was about to turn 12. What Catherine knows, what we all know, is that the Negro and Native Reeducation Act mandates that at 12 years old, all Negroes and any Indians living in a protectorate must enroll in a combat school for the betterment of themselves and of society. The argument went that we benefited from compulsory education, as it provides a livelihood for formerly enslaved who couldn't find gainful employment after the war. Whites, therefore, were excluded from the law, although some went to the combat schools of their own accord, since it was good to know how to protect oneself in these dangerous times. Still, there's a difference between an education officer showing up with a group of armed men and carrying someone off, and their enrolling in a school on their own.
Lily is fair, Jackson says. She's passing, like you, Catherine. I figured if she lived with a white family, the education officers would leave her alone. The Spencers are egalitarians, and they don't truck with the survivalists and all their nonsense about Negroes being inferior.
Jackson sits heavily in one of the chairs.
I just wanted to keep her safe.
There's so much heartache in his voice that I almost go to him. almost offer what little comfort I can. But that ain't my place anymore. And I swallow my concern like a bitter draft. That's when a chorus